December 2nd, 2015. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Election Day 2015 comes tomorrow, and in three states, governorships are at stake. Those three states are Kentucky, Mississippi, and Louisiana. In Kentucky, the Republican candidate Matt Bevin will be facing off against the Democratic nominee Jack Conway, currently the state's attorney general. The interesting thing about the Kentucky race is that one of the most important issues is something that right now is not before the state in terms of the legislative agenda, but it may soon be. That is the issue of same-sex marriage. The citizens of Kentucky had adopted a constitutional amendment defining marriage exclusively as the union of a man and a woman, but that came under fire from United States Federal District Court judge who ruled that the Kentucky constitutional amendment is unconstitutional. That set the Commonwealth of Kentucky in an interesting position, and it grew more interesting because the Attorney General of the state, none other than Jack Conway, refused to defend the Kentucky constitutional amendment in federal court. That led to the governor of the state, another Democrat, Steve Beshear, hiring an independent counsel to defend Kentucky's constitutional amendment in court because the constitutional officer assigned that responsibility, Attorney General Jack Conway, refused to do so, saying that he found the constitutional amendment discriminatory. All of this led, of course, to the eventual Obergefell decision, in which the state of Kentucky was very much at the center of the story, when the Supreme Court, in June of this year, handed down its decision legalizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states. But the issue of same-sex marriage hasn't departed the scene. As is now well known nationally, the case of a Kentucky county clerk, Kim Davis, has gained national attention, and that has put the Commonwealth of Kentucky back in the headlines and on the hot seat with the issue of same-sex marriage, because the upcoming General Assembly is expected to take up the question as to whether or not the legislature will remove Kim Davis from her post because of the fact that she has refused to issue same-sex marriage licenses, or that is, marriage licenses to same-sex couples, so long as she was required to put her name on the licenses. This is going to set up a very interesting situation in Kentucky that will extend beyond the gubernatorial election, but there should be no question that this has become one of those issues that has been a focal point in terms of issues of morality in the 2015 Kentucky gubernatorial race. The interesting thing to note in this is that even as the Supreme Court handed down its decision just this past June, legalizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states, that doesn't mean that the issue is over. That's a very clear lesson to be learned here. The outworkings of the logic of same-sex marriage, the bureaucratic and policy issues that pertain to same-sex marriage, the moral revolution that has led to the legalization of same-sex marriage, these issues will not end with the Supreme Court's decision, any more than on the abortion issue. The Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 settled the issue. Now, as we look to the 2015 Kentucky election for governor, it's clear that this is not the only issue of public concern. But it's also clear that the issue of same-sex marriage and the issue of Kentucky's attorney general not defending the Kentucky constitutional amendment in federal court, that these are illustrative of the larger worldview divide between the two candidates. It's going to be an interesting election expected to be very close in Kentucky tomorrow. And as we will see, the issue of same-sex marriage is not a standalone issue. It is tied to a host of other issues as well. And how Kentucky goes in this race is going to send a signal of how these issues are likely to develop in other states as well. Before leaving this particular race, I need to note, as a matter of disclosure, that Matt Bevin is a personal friend, and he has been a very generous donor to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. But personal issues aside, because of this issue and others, the eyes of the nation are likely on Election Day tomorrow to be looking very closely at Kentucky. They'll also be looking at least two other major elections, one in Texas and one in Ohio. They are not for the office of governor. In Ohio, the issue is a constitutional amendment that would allow the limited legalization of recreational marijuana. This is a very interesting development, interesting on at least several grounds. In the first place, it's interesting that this vote is taking place in Ohio. Heretofore, most of the legalization issues that have arisen amongst the states or the District of Columbia have taken place along the coasts and in more liberal areas than the state of Ohio. Another interesting issue is that if Ohio indeed adopts this constitutional amendment legalizing marijuana, it will be the first state in the nation to do so without going through the, at least heretofore, intermediary step of legalizing so-called medical marijuana. But the issue in Ohio has taken a very interesting turn in recent weeks. And that's because, in many ways, the focal issue in Ohio is now framed as a marijuana monopoly. If Ohioans adopt this constitutional amendment legalizing marijuana, they will actually be creating, in effect, a marijuana monopoly in terms of the for-profit industry. And there are some clear moral and worldview issues for us to note here. In the first place, this entire effort to legalize marijuana has been, in effect, bought and paid for. Political activists have poured millions and millions of dollars into this effort to legalize marijuana in the state by this constitutional amendment, and they have been funded by the very people likely to be making hundreds of millions, eventually billions of dollars, through the sale of marijuana. In effect, the constitutional amendment, if adopted, would set up a monopoly in which legal marijuana on a commercial basis can be grown on only 10 specific parcels of land that happen to be owned by private industry that intends to go in a big way into the marijuana business. As many have noted all across the nation, nothing like this has ever happened before, where state voters have been asked to adopt a constitutional amendment that would, in effect, give a monopoly on legal marijuana to 10 particular parcels of land and the owners and controllers of that property. And now, the Ohio State Legislature has responded by putting another constitutional amendment on the same ballot before the voters of Ohio that would preclude any constitutional amendment that would benefit specific private industries in this way. This sets up a very interesting constitutional situation in Ohio, particularly if both of these amendments were to pass, because that would mean that tomorrow the citizens of Ohio would vote for two contradictory constitutional amendments. At this point, no one knows exactly what would happen in Ohio if that were to happen. It would certainly send the issue into the courts, and there's no telling where that might go. But the worldview implications of the vote in Ohio are really, really interesting, because what this tells us is that the legalization of marijuana and the moral normalization of its use is now being funded directly, honestly, and right up front by big business. As the New York Times has noted, this is a shift from the symbolism of the hippie movement for marijuana legalization to the men in suits. As Mitch Smith and Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times report, and I quote, "Issue 3, as the proposed amendment is known, is bankrolled by wealthy investors spending nearly $25 million to put it on the ballot and sell it to voters. If it passes, they will have exclusive rights to growing commercial marijuana in Ohio. The proposal, says the New York Times, has a strange bedfellow coalition of opponents, law enforcement officers worried about crime, doctors worried about children's health, state lawmakers and others who warn that it would enshrine a monopoly in the Ohio Constitution. As the reporters say, the result has been one of the nation's oddest legalization campaigns. It sets, as they point out, a new generation of corporate investors against grassroots advocates. By the way, advocates for the legalization of marijuana. There are those who want the movement for legalized marijuana to be non-commercial. But one of the things we need to note from a Christian worldview perspective is that when you set something loose in society, there is always an economic dimension. And where there is an economic dimension, surely as big as the commercial market for marijuana, then you're going to have big business move in a very big way. The New York Times story tells of how the political movement behind this was started as political activists funded by these commercial interests got the necessary signatures and got the constitutional amendment on the ballot. One of the persons cited in the article had said, quote, "We have clearly taken this from the tie-dye to the suit and tie approach. There is no question about that." One of the industry spokespersons said, quote, "Right, wrong, or indifferent, this is the way legalization is moving in this country now," end quote. In one sense, those operating out of a Christian worldview should understand that this shows the natural progression. When an issue like marijuana moves from being a so-called grassroots movement, no pun intended, to now being a major corporate push. And now you're also saying that there is a cultural backlash, but the interesting backlash in terms of the New York Times isn't coming from those primarily who are against the legalization of marijuana, but rather those who may be for it but are against the commercialization of it. But as this article makes very clear, one way or another, that commercialization is going to take place. That's a very important issue for us to note. Marijuana is surely not the most important moral issue facing the nation, although it is a very large moral issue. It's a large issue, as we have seen, because marijuana is not a neutral substance. It is indeed intended to have a hallucinogenic effect, and that sets up a host of moral issues. But as we have seen also, marijuana becomes symbolic of the larger moral revolution. And we have noted, as many others have, on both sides of the issue, that the issue of the normalization of marijuana and its legalization as so-called recreational marijuana has tracked the moral movement in the nation on the very question of same-sex marriage. In terms of morality and how these moral issues come about, one final observation. As the New York Times tells us, quote, "Perhaps the most contentious marketing effort has been Buddy, an anthropomorphic marijuana bud," that means a cartoon character, "that looks like a spear of asparagus wearing green cowboy boots and a blue cape, who has been turning up on college campuses around the state. Critics have compared him to Joe Camel, the cartoon character accused of marketing Camel cigarettes to children. As the reporters tell us, on the campus of the University of Cincinnati, Buddy posed for photos and found no shortage of fans among students. Most eagerly accepted free T-shirts, the reporters tell us, with messages like Ohio, that's O-H-I-G-H-O. Many who stopped were passionate about legalization. Others, said the reporter, seemed to care a little about it. One student cited told the campaign workers who were with Buddy, that is the cartoon character, that he, quote, worried about the big businesses getting an edge on the market right away, end quote. We'll be watching the situation in the state of Ohio very carefully. We'll also be watching the city of Houston, where another major issue is also on the ballot. As Sandhya Someshikar reports for the Washington Post, the issue in Houston is a so-called non-discrimination law. As she writes, the campaign to pass the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, it's also known by the acronym HERO, has become a priority for national gay rights groups and the city's gay mayor, as well as for local business leaders, who fear an economic backlash similar to the one that hammered Indiana earlier this year if it is not adopted. But, she writes, with an election set for tomorrow, polls show voters are divided on the measure, and some analysts are predicting defeat. The next sentence is very interesting. She writes, quote, "One reason, they say, is the provocative claim that the measure would permit, quote, any man at any time to enter a woman's bathroom simply by claiming to be a woman that day. Opponents," she says, "have dubbed the measure the bathroom ordinance." Now, there is an important background story to the situation in Houston, and many of you will recall it immediately. Back in May of 2014, the city of Houston's city council adopted the similar ordinance, virtually the same language, and they adopted it under the leadership of Houston Mayor Anise Parker, a Democrat, who was the nation's first big city openly gay mayor when she was elected back in 2009. But voters in Houston have the opportunity, by means of a referendum that requires signatures on a ballot to get it before voters, to repeal an ordinance undertaken by the city council. That led to an epic showdown, because even as a sufficient number of signatures were gathered, largely by churches and church leaders, in order to put the issue before Houston voters, the opportunity to repeal, the mayor of the city, backed by the city council, sued the organization that had gathered the signatures and led the repeal effort. And then, in a stunning development that is still without precedent in American history, the mayor of Houston, through the city attorney, ordered five pastors in Houston to turn over, as a matter of evidence, their sermons preached on the issue of homosexuality, any sermon preached on homosexuality during the time that the repeal effort was underway. It was one of the most clear and indeed blatant violations of religious liberty in our time, and one of the most obviously unconstitutional efforts undertaken by any political leader in the United States. When Houston's city attorney sought to subpoena the sermons from the pastors, the mayor took to Twitter and tweeted, quote, "If the five pastors use pulpits for politics, their sermons are fair game," end quote. That statement, coming from an elected official in the United States, their sermons are fair game, should be some of the most chilling words that any of us can hear in terms of religious liberty. Under political pressure and legal pressure, the mayor and the city council, along with the city attorney, had to back off the request for subpoenas for those particular sermons. They did not back off the attempt to shut down the repeal effort. This came this past July before the Texas Supreme Court, when that court ruled that the ordinance would either have to be repealed or the matter would have to be put directly to the voters. That's what's taking place tomorrow. In a very interesting op-ed piece, very revealing in its own way, Mimi Schwartz, the executive editor at Texas Monthly, wrote this piece in the New York Times in which she says, quote, "Houston likes to call itself the city of the future. This is," she writes, "after all, the nation's fourth largest metropolis and one of its most diverse. Oil is in a slump, yes, but skyscrapers and luxury condos are still rising. World-class architects are gussying up our parks and museums. But," she says, "our super sophisticated self-conception is now endangered thanks to months of strife that have led to a November 3 ballot on Proposition 1, a measure also known as the bathroom ordinance." Now, one of the most interesting things about this op-ed piece is that Mimi Schwartz clearly wants to say that it's not about bathrooms, but she's never actually able to say that. The reason for that is simple. It is, in essence, about the bathrooms. Instead, Mimi Schwartz is arguing that this particular anti-discrimination ordinance is basically for everybody. This is what she writes, quote, "It is designed to protect the populace from discrimination in housing, employment, and just about everything else, on just about any basis, race, age, pregnancy, religion, ethnicity, military status, disability, sexual orientation, and gender identity," end quote. Now, what's really very sly about that is that in that long list, the only thing that would actually be new are the issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. That's because everything else is already covered by either local, state, or federal coverage and anti-discrimination, and generally on all those issues, at all three levels. Thus, it is disingenuous to suggest it's just an innocuous, comprehensive anti-discrimination law. The only thing that's controversial about it in this case, and the focal point, the only thing that's really new in terms of the coverage under this ordinance, will be sexual orientation and gender identity. It's going to be very, very interesting to watch what the voters in Houston do tomorrow. They're also, by the way, going to be electing a new mayor. But there's something else also to note here, and that's the corporate angle, even as in Ohio. In this case, it's just as upfront. Because as was the case with the Boy Scouts of America, and as this news story in the Washington Post said, as was the case in Indiana, when that state's legislature adopted a form of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and then that legislation was signed into law by the governor, the state of Indiana faced an enormous backlash. And now you have this warning coming in the Washington Post and in the New York Times that Houston may lose its national and international reputation as being a progressive and sophisticated city. It may lose its attractiveness as a seat for corporate offices and Fortune 500 corporations if indeed the voters of Houston do not adopt this anti-discrimination ordinance. And one other thing to note is that, as in Indiana, another issue looming in the background is sports and the big money and prestige that comes with big sporting events. Advocates of the ordinance are warning their fellow Houstonians that if they do not pass this measure, at stake might be Houston's rights to host the Super Bowl in 2017. Indications are that the bathroom issue has been very, very important to Houston citizens. And that's because, in spite of the fact that people tried to dismiss the issue, it is actually something that will be covered without question in this new ordinance. And this has led to a lot of people in Houston asking some very basic questions. And of course, as we have seen, this points to the fact that the transgender revolution has a giant conflict of liberties at its very core. And the issue of bathrooms and who may use which bathroom is indeed very much at stake. And that's one reason why we'll be watching Houston, among other places, very closely tomorrow. Finally, in terms of worldview, every comprehensive worldview has to answer at least four questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? What's gone wrong with the world? Can anything be done about it? And where is everything headed? That last question has my attention when a recent story ran in the Wall Street Journal. Here's the headline: Far in Space, a Glimpse into How the Earth May End. It shows us that regardless of worldview, everyone is concerned with how the end will come and what shape it will take. And that includes those who operate out of an exclusively materialistic or naturalistic worldview. As Gautam Naik for the Wall Street Journal reports, astronomers have made the first direct discovery of a planet being ripped apart by the tremendous forces unleashed by a dying star. A possible glimpse, he says, into how the Earth will end its days. He goes on to tell us the cosmic drama is occurring 570 light years from Earth in the constellation Virgo, where a sun-like star is reaching the end of its life and annihilating its solar system. The researchers discovered a small planet being vaporized by the star's searing heat and ripped apart by its gravity. Later in the article, he writes, quote, "Our sun will go through a similar process about 5 billion years from now," scientists say. Because of its proximity to the sun, he goes on to say, there is a chance that Earth will be engulfed by the red giant that forms. Even if Earth survives the sun's red giant phase, he writes, other forces will claim it. The subsequent white dwarf, he writes, could destabilize the orbits of planets, including Earth's, and cause many of them to fall toward the white dwarf and disintegrate. That appears to be the scenario, he says, unfolding in Virgo. He then cites Carole Mundell, head of astrophysics at the University of Bath in England, who said, quote, "It's a glimpse into the future of Earth." She concluded, "It reinforces the idea that we are in a much more hostile environment than we sometimes imagine," end quote. Well, no doubt we are in a far more hostile environment than many imagine. The really important thing for us to recognize is that the worldview implications are clear, even as the modern scientific, secular, materialistic worldview must answer in its own way the question of origins. It does that, we should note, at least in part, with the Big Bang theory and the theory of evolution. It also is accountable to answer where history is going, and here you have evidence of how that fits into that materialistic, naturalistic worldview as well. What we need to note is that every intelligent person really does believe that it's all going to come to an end. The question for every worldview, of course, is how and by what, or as we would say, by whom. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Tampa, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.